Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Understanding the Importance of Clinical Trials, What You Need to Know. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 726 participants, so there's a lot of you on the call today, and you're from all over the United States, from all different parts of the country, and we also have international participants from Canada, Jordan, Kuwait, Malaysia, and the United Kingdom, so you really are a global call. You're from all over the world as well. And I would like to take a moment and turn your attention to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information, the outline that our speakers have prepared, it's information about our speakers, and there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource for each of you to use. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can tell us the topics that you would like us to offer going forward. Indeed, today's topic is one that many of you have expressed interest in, and you can tell you've obviously expressed interest in it, and then there are so many of you on the call today. So clearly, we take your recommendations seriously. I think this is a good example of that. And so please tell us what you'd like us to do, and we will offer those programs. Now, today's program is made possible by an educational grant from GlaxoSmithKline Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Leonard, Dr. John Leonard. Dr. Leonard is the Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College, Clinical Director, New York Cornell Center for Lymphoma and Myeloma. He's also Chief Lymphoma Myeloma Service and Associate Director for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Cancer Center. And Dr. Leonard is going to address what are clinical trials, why are they important, and how are clinical trials conducted. It's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Leonard.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and I'd like to particularly thank you and the group at Cancer Care for organizing this important teleconference, as well as the other speakers and, in particular, the audience for joining us today. This is really a very important area and something that anyone dealing with cancer, or frankly any medical issue, needs to know something about. So my first topic relates to really what are clinical trials, what is a clinical trial, and it is an extremely important area for people to understand and consider as they deal with a particular illness, whether it's them or their friends or family members. So clinical trials also can be called clinical studies. It is basically a clinical trial is a tool, it's a process by which we can learn about a disease. And in the context of cancer, clinical trials or clinical studies that are focused on accomplishing several different goals. Some of these may relate to looking at patients with cancer, as an example, and saying, why did this happen? What are the features of the patient that led to this? But that would be more of a clinical study, but many clinical trials are really focused on defining a better treatment. I think for patients that is often the most important thing. Many of our cancer treatments are effective, but in many situations the treatments are less effective than we would like or more toxic than we would like, and there are lots and lots of new options and ideas and potentially new treatments out there for just about every type of cancer. And so the question that comes up for those of us dealing with it is, how are these new treatments, how can we bring them forward? And so clinical trials are the process by which we learn about the disease and largely are focused in cancer around either preventing the disease or most commonly treating the disease, or in some cases watching patients in the longer term to learn more about them in the long term once they've dealt with the disease, issues of trying to keep the disease from coming back, et cetera. And so they are important because of the fact that really any time a patient goes into their doctor's office and is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, the doctor is explaining, or the rest of the medical team are explaining to the patient, here is your diagnosis, here is your situation, here is what we expect out of this disease process, this is how we propose to treat it, these are the options that we have, and this is how we expect it to work, these are the expected side effects. And so all of that information that is obviously essential for a patient dealing with cancer is they want to know how they're going to do, want to plan their life, want to hopefully get the best treatment, hopefully be cured of the disease or live longer and feel better. All of this information is essential when one speaks with one's doctor. And so what the doctor does and the team, the treatment team does, is look at information from clinical trials and say, this is what we expect out of this, this is how we're going to treat you, this is what our expectations are as far as how well this treatment is expected to work and what are the expected side effects. And for many patients, it comes down to you're choosing between treatment A and treatment B. And so the issue of trying to assess, well, is treatment A the right treatment, is treatment B the right treatment, one really needs very rigorously generated information. You don't want your doctor saying, well, the last three people I treated with this, this is how it turned out. What you really want to know is, well, how did the 1,000 people or the 100 people treated with this regimen, how did they do, what did they experience? Because that is really much more rigorous and robust and valid information for one to make an important decision. So the concept of clinical trials in cancer take on a number of different forms, and the other speakers are going to touch on different aspects of this, so we'll slightly overlap, but mostly I think kind of complement what we're saying to each other. But the idea of a clinical trial is largely that a group of people working in the field, it can be physicians, it can be scientists, researchers, it can be nurses, social workers, other care providers, depending on the issue, say as a group, gee, we have an important question to answer about this disease, or we have an idea for a new treatment for this disease, which, again, for many patients is a paramount issue. And so often clinical trials are focused on those sorts of questions. They are questions that say, I have a new treatment regimen. We have reason to think that this may be useful. How can we determine, is this a good treatment regimen, and so on. And so most clinical trials are really developed when a group of people interested in the area work together, and this can be at one institution, at your hospital or at your medical college or your doctor's office. They can perform clinical trials. Many clinical trials are done in groups across the country where groups come together and work together to say, these are the issues facing patients with, let's say, breast cancer. We have this problem. Our patients are dealing with this issue. What can we do to make it better? And the group may get together and say, let's study this issue, or I have an idea to address this issue. And so let's take this idea forward and look at it and study it. This treatment regimen or this particular problem, let's do it in an organized fashion. And in cancer, much of the issues, again, are centered around new treatments and new drugs. And so around clinical trials with new drugs, it can be we have a standard treatment for this particular type of cancer in this situation. There is a group that says we can try to make it better. We have an idea about how to make it better, whether it be more effective or less toxic. And so what we're going to do is design a study where we can try to take that forward. And so that may be adding a new drug to a standard treatment, substituting a new drug for part of a standard treatment, or it can be developing a new drug or a new treatment regimen in a situation where the treatment options are very limited and not very effective. Most clinical trials then start with an idea, and then they are developed into what's called a protocol, which is basically a written document, a long, detailed written document that talks about the rationale for doing the clinical trial, for doing the study, and the specifics of what's actually going to be done. And that is a document that is generated through a process which, depending on the situation, can take a great deal of time. And I think from the patient's perspective, it's very good because by the time when the time that a treatment team or a physician offers a patient to participation in a clinical trial, one can say that that clinical trial has been developed over a long period of time, has been reviewed by many different people, and has been really optimized and turned into the best and most rigorous sort of way to develop a new treatment or to conduct the research. And so most of the time what happens is that a clinical trial is developed after a lot of discussion with different groups of people working in the field. It may include a pharmaceutical company and may largely relate to a pharmaceutical company if it's a drug that a pharmaceutical company is developing. Many of the clinical trials relating to cancer are done at individual institutions, at individual treatment centers, or the majority of clinical trials, I would say, are done at many centers across the country where in some cases it's a company or in many cases it's a what we call a cooperative group, a group of treatment centers working together. Often these are funded by the National Cancer Institute and indirectly the government, basically work together to develop a treatment regimen, a treatment plan over many months and say, okay, we are going to compare treatment A versus treatment B, or we are going to develop a new treatment A. And so what we're going to do is put our heads together and outline a plan, put it on paper, have it reviewed by many different experts in the field, different aspects of the field, and at the end of the day, we will generate what's termed a protocol, which is basically a document that summarizes what exactly is going to happen in this study. And that ranges, that document includes information of who is eligible for this study, who is eligible for this program, who is the group of patients that we were going to study, what are the requirements to go on the study, what we call eligibility criteria, because there may be certain patients who it would be inappropriate or unsafe for them to participate in the study. And then it is the screening test, what is done with a patient when they go on the study to essentially assess the lay of the land. And then the procedures that the patient is going to undergo, and that may be a treatment regimen, it may be a standard treatment regimen, it may be a different treatment regimen, it may be a twist on the standard treatment regimen. What's the monitoring that's going to happen? What's the follow-up that's going to happen? And then at the end of the day, what are the data information that are going to be collected that ultimately will then be summarized for the group of patients on the study and then ultimately be made available to the community to say, yes, this is the nature of this treatment and this is how it all turned out and basically how does this compare to some of the other options. And so for a patient perspective, and I'm going to finish my portion of things, I'm sure there'll be more details and complimentary information from the other speakers, but at the end of the day, the idea here is that this is the step that we need to take to bring new treatment forward. And any therapeutic treatment that a patient has been treated for cancer has undergone this sort of process that basically has defined the nature of the treatment and moved it forward and in many cases moved it forward versus prior less effective and or more toxic treatments. The new treatments that have come forward over time and will continue to go forward over time go through this process. And from the patient perspective, it is contributing to this information so that it helps all of us. But for many cases for a patient, this offers an opportunity to get a new approach or a new treatment that potentially can, down the road, pay off for them as far as improving their outcome. And that may or may not ultimately be the case with a clinical trial, and I'm sure the other speakers will touch on it, but this is basically the way that we move things forward, and I think it's very important for patients to consider participation in this process. Because, again, it can help not only all of us from increasing our knowledge, but also helping the individual patient. So with that, I will stop and let the other speakers pick up the ball, and I think by the end we'll have a fairly global picture of what this all entails.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lennon. Really an exquisite presentation, very informative and comprehensive. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. D. Lawrence Wickerham. Dr. Wickerham is Associate Chairman, National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Project, or NSABP. And Dr. Wickerham is going to address where are clinical trials conducted, what happens in a clinical trial, and the meaning of informed consent. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Wickerham.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's certainly a pleasure to be here as well and to participate in the Cancer Care Workshop. As you've heard, I work for this NSABP group. It's one of our National Cancer Institute's cooperative trials groups, and it's been around now for over 50 years. We conduct clinical trials in the treatment and, more recently, prevention of both breast and bowel cancer. My first topic is, where are trials conducted? And in the distant past, all clinical trials, for the most part, were done almost exclusively in major university hospitals or comprehensive care centers, cancer centers. And those trials are still available in each of those institutions today, particularly phase one trials. These are early studies in the development of an individual drug or treatment, often represent the first time that a particular therapy is used in humans. They tend to be small studies, only in a handful of patients. And the focus of the study is on the safety of that treatment. It requires a lot of specialty care, a lot of intense follow-up, and are ideally situated for major university centers. However, not all cancer care occurs in New York City or Chicago or Los Angeles. And for now over 30 years, our National Cancer Institute has made it made a major effort to make clinical trials available elsewhere, particularly in non-university community-based settings. This allows access to state-of-the-art clinical trials much closer to home for individual patients and without the costs or the burdens of travel to the major urban settings. It allows them to get their care close to home with the support of their family and friends and still get high-quality cancer care. Many patients think about the term clinical trials as a last-ditch effort, to be considered only after the standard treatments are no longer working. And again, phase one trials are available for such settings and phase two studies as well. But often, studies with the biggest benefit to individual patients are those that are begun at the time of initial diagnosis. These tend to be larger studies that involve hundreds, if not thousands, of patients, are easily available in the community, and is certainly something to consider. I like to tell people all the time that clinical trials in general should be a first choice, not simply a last resort. So what happens within these clinical trials? Dr. Leonard's outlined some of this, and I can follow right along with that. The first step is to determine if you're eligible for a particular trial. Trials involve groups of patients that are similar in a variety of ways. They come in different sizes. They can be tens of patients, hundreds, and as I mentioned, even thousands. They're designed to evaluate new therapies, and we use that information from the results of a clinical trial to improve the treatment of the general population of patients that are similar to those that entered the study. Eligibility determination may require additional testing. That can be blood work, it can be x-rays, and sometimes even evaluation of a particular tumor. It involves informed consent, and I'll describe that in a little bit more detail in a few moments. If you pass all of those steps, then you actually enter the study. Depending on the design of the trial, that's usually the entry process is when the specific therapy that you will receive is determined. You go on to receive that therapy as described. There are non-therapeutic trials, but really not the topic of today's discussion. As you receive your treatment, you're monitored. How is it impacting my cancer? Is it improving things? We look very carefully at side effects and toxicities. And then you're followed not only during the treatment phase, but beyond treatment as well. That can be for months or years, and in some cases, even decades of follow-up. we look at the results of your care, but we also compile the similar sorts of findings from all of the individuals who enter the specific trial. Those results are analyzed and then eventually reported to the medical community and in many cases to the rest of the world. So when are trial results available? Well, Dr. Leonard mentioned these protocol documents. You can often look at that as a rule book that describes how we conduct these trials and provides an outline of all of the components of the study, including the statistical section, which describes how many patients are going to be necessary to enter the trial to allow us to effectively reach the conclusions we want. What are our expectations of the study? What sort of assumptions are we making within the design of the trial? And when will the trial be fully analyzed? What sorts of things need to occur to allow us to analyze the study? Now, it's important to realize that safety is analyzed on an ongoing basis. So if there are undue side effects that are a surprise, those are rapidly identified. Let's talk about the meaning of informed consent. Trials are experiments. They're highly controlled, highly regulated. They come with lots of oversight and review to help ensure the quality of the care and the safety, but in many ways they are still experiments. And you can choose to enter this experiment. We want you to have a full understanding of the study and your rights and your obligations should you choose to enter that trial. And you need to provide your approval, your consent to participate in this study. And informed consent is a process that's designed to explain the study and to allow you to make a reasoned or an informed choice to participate or not. The informed consent document is often the first step in this process. It's, in theory, in straightforward language, describes the trial. That language may be straightforward, but often they are long documents. And it's important for you to read through the informed consent document fully, to have a full understanding of it, and to take the time to ask any questions that you might have about any and all pieces of the informed consent document. The description of the study usually includes why the research is being done, why you are being asked to enter the study, how many people overall will eventually be in the research trial, and what is involved. And you'll get an outline of what will occur should you choose to enter the study. Risks and the potential benefits of entering the trial are also included in the informed consent document. And interestingly, alternative therapies for the treatment of patients like yourself outside of the trial. What else might be available outside of the study? There's usually a discussion of any costs that may occur to you or to your insurance company should you enter the trial, and a description of your rights as a participant, including the right to withdraw from the study at any point in time, to stop the treatment and to stop additional follow-up. And then there is frequently a section, who to call should you have questions beyond your individual physician. Who else can you contact about this particular trial? You should be given a copy of the informed consent document. I would urge you to keep that as a part of your important papers at home. But as I mentioned, consent is not just this informed consent document. It's truly an ongoing obligation. If new information becomes available during the course of the trial that might impact your willingness to continue, you would be informed of that information. This could be new toxicity information concerning that particular treatment. It may be new benefits. And it could be information from outside of the trial about additional therapies or additional information that may prove to be valuable for you. But nonetheless, this all becomes an important part of participating in clinical trials. Let me stop there, and I will turn this back to Carolyn.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Wickham, again, for just a very informative and very comprehensive presentation, and I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Edith Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell is clinical professor of medicine and medical oncology, Department of Medical Oncology, associate director of diversity programs, Kimmel Cancer Center, Thomas Jefferson University. And also, Dr. Mitchell will be receiving the Humanitarian Award at the annual Society of Clinical Oncology's annual meeting in June. So congratulations to Dr. Mitchell. And Dr. Mitchell is going to address today on the call benefits and risks of participation in clinical trials, specific questions to ask your healthcare team about clinical trials, and accessing resources for clinical trials. I'm now going to turn the program over to Dr. Mitchell.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and it is a delight to be on this conference call today. I am very appreciative of your invitation and to the other speakers who have so eloquently discussed the clinical trials, and to our listeners who we all depend on because our patients are our most important entity. And as we add to the discussions that have been conducted already on clinical trials, I'm going to try and show the benefit of clinical trials. So as Dr. Leonard and Dr. Wickerham have stated, clinical trials are medical research studies that involve people. The aim of these studies is frequently to test a different treatment, to find out how safe, how well a treatment works. But the overall goal is to improve healthcare. And this is how our healthcare really has been developed over years. It's how standard treatments have been developed. And the clinical trials aim to find the best ways to do a number of things. They could be to prevent disease and reduce the number of people who become ill with a certain disease. Another could be to treat illnesses, to either improve survival or to delay or prevent suffering from disease, and to improve and increase the number of people who are cured of the disease. It could be to improve the quality of life of individuals with certain illnesses, or in some cases to diagnose disease and health problems. And when we think about clinical care in the United States, we're all familiar with some of the largest clinical trials that have been conducted and some that have had the greatest impact on individuals in the United States, one of which is polio. Years ago, when polio was very common in this country as well as others, there were clinical trials conducted and large polio vaccinations such that we don't hear of that disease anymore. Another has been insulin for diabetes. And we can go on to name many others. But the ultimate goal of all of these clinical trials was to improve healthcare. So with improvement, how does one decide then to enter or to participate in a clinical trial? The first, I believe, is to understand what is the disease process. So for cancer, for example, we need to ask the questions of your doctors and nurses and the other healthcare team members. What is the disease? What is the stage of the disease? So that you can get a really good understanding of not only the disease process, but what is standard care? What does standard care involve? And once you know what standard care involves and what most patients with that disease, with that stage of the disease, receive its treatment, then one can begin the process of evaluating whether or not to participate in a clinical trial. And with a clinical trial, you want to know, what is the best way of treating me at this time, and what are some of the information that is lacking in the treatment, in the standard treatment. And once that information is there and the patient is comfortable that they understand, then you can begin to look at options. What are the clinical trials available for this disease? What is the trial all about? Who sponsors the trial? What are the risks of participating in the trial? And more importantly, what are the benefits? What can a patient expect to gain by participating in this clinical trial? As Dr. Leonard and Dr. Wickerham have stated, clinical trials are developed by experts in the field. They are designed to, number one, maximize the benefit for the patient, and also to minimize the risk for the patient. All medications have some benefit and some risk. Every single drug that I am aware of has, in addition to its expected benefit, it has some potential risk, and therefore the patient will want to know that. What are the side effects that you can expect from participating in a clinical trial, but also what are some of the side effects that you can expect from standard therapy, because again, standard therapy does have some risk and benefits. In all of the trials, there may be some risk, there may be additional benefits, and therefore it will be important for you to understand that. Now, as a part of participating in a clinical trial, one will want to know who will evaluate the data and the end results. Is it the FDA or the Food and Drug Administration? In which, in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, is one of the bodies that evaluates the results of many of the clinical trials. So it's the mechanism by which medications become available to us in the United States, both in terms of the physicians for treatment and the patients for receiving treatment. So this is how we develop better treatments. This is how our treatments improve for patients. And it is these carefully designed clinical trials that allow us to thereby improve care. So what kind of questions should the patient ask? First of all, ask about the clinical trial. Who is sponsoring the clinical trial? Who reviews the information? Where are the data collected? Is it just one hospital or one group doing the clinical trial? As Dr. Wickerham said, many times in the past, the major university hospitals were the ones conducting clinical trials. But now in the United States, we have processes that have allowed for clinical trials to be available for most patients and for most healthcare workers, so that clinical trials are allowed, there are processes that allow participation in almost any clinical setting. But you will want to know, what are the benefits and risks of participating in the clinical trial? What will happen if you don't participate in the clinical trial? And if you do, what does the treatment involve? How many visits to the hospital or center will be necessary? Whether or not there are travel costs that might be covered by the clinical trial. Where can you get more information about that clinical trial? And will insurance cover the cost? or if insurance does not cover the cost, who does cover the cost, and what are these costs likely to be? So it's really important to understand. It's also important to understand what is the phase of that trial. Is it a phase one, a phase two, phase three, or phase four? So all of these are important. Now, where do you get information on clinical trials? The first place should be your physician or the healthcare team. Your healthcare team should be available to answer any questions about the disease process, about treatment, about standard treatment, and about clinical trials. Once that information is obtained, there are many sources of information on the web, and you can get a lot of information from the web, but not all of those sources are reliable. One of the most reliable sites on the web for obtaining information, especially on cancer clinical trials, but on many other disease processes, is called clinicaltrials.gov. And for most of the clinical trials that are of benefit to patients that are reliable are registered on clinicaltrials.gov, and therefore you can get that information there. But I encourage patients to always talk to your healthcare team, always talk to your doctor, ask the questions, and thereby make sure that you're in good communications with your healthcare team, because they can be very helpful, they can give you a lot of information, and they can help you as you make the decision, but not only after the decision is made, whether you receive standard care or whether you enter a clinical trial, it's very important for the patient to feel comfortable that you are getting the very best care available. So your goal as a patient would be to get the best care available, and if that care is through a clinical trial, you deserve the comfort of knowing that and knowing that your questions have been answered. So with that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to discuss this with you today, and I look forward to the questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mitchell, really for, again, outstanding presentation and really for really reviewing many of the issues and questions that people have, and particularly a focus on really talking with their healthcare team is a very, very important resource, as well as the National Cancer Institute website as well, or toll-free number. Thank you. Well, now we do have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to go ahead and bring all of our speakers on board, and then we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And Stephanie, if you would explain to the audience how to queue up questions, and we'll take as many as we can. Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
And we do have a question for one of our online participants, from William. Who is responsible for collecting and keeping and storing all the data in a clinical trial? Dr. Wickham, do you want to address that?
I will. It varies from trial to trial, but it is included in the informed consent document, as well as the importance of maintaining confidentiality, which is why it's there. You indeed want to know who is collecting, who has access to your records. Dr. Mitchell mentioned the Food and Drug Administration. That does occur, the National Cancer Institute, and often the pharmaceutical companies that are involved in the support of the trial will also have access. Smaller center, single-center trials, it may only be that particularly university or hospital.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay. And Stephanie, our next question?
Our next question comes from Ethel M. Your line is open.
I'd like to know what the difference is between the different phases you mentioned, phase 1, 2, 3, and 4. What does that mean?
Oh, excellent. Thank you for that question. Dr. Mitchell, would you like to review that?
Oh, yes. So the phases of the study depend on what is actually being evaluated. So, for example, in medication studies, and medication studies are not the only type of studies. There can be evaluation of devices, evaluation of different surgical procedures. But a phase one study usually evaluates the safety of an entity. So if it's a new drug, for example, the phase one study is designed to evaluate what are the side effects and what is the safety of that particular drug. For a phase two study, it means that the drug has gone through a phase one study. We know what the side effects are. We know what to expect, bad things that could happen from a drug, and we know what to expect in terms of effects that the patient might experience. So then in phase two studies, these are designed to figure out what disease entity would be the best one for this drug to treat. So in the cancer arena, for example, which is where I work, we would want to know, is this drug effective in breast cancer or lung cancer or ovarian cancer or leukemia? In other words, where will the drug be utilized? Which kind of cancer? And for phase three studies, that means that the drug has already gone through phase one and phase two. We know what the side effect profile is. We know which cancer is most likely to show benefit. And in phase three, we are interested in knowing how does this new treatment compare with the old or standard treatment. So patients will be randomized in phase three studies, for example, to whatever was the old or standard treatment, and another group of patients will receive the new treatment. And then we will evaluate the results to see if the new treatment is better than the old treatment. And then in phase four, this is expanded access, and we want to know in a wider arena how it works. So basically, that's a brief summary of the various phases of clinical trials, especially as it pertains to drugs. But the patients should always ask the doctors who are doing the trial, what is the phase of the trial? Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you. Our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Mrs. Barbara L. Your line is open.
Yes, I have an extremely rare head and neck cancer of the parotid gland and the lymph nodes called acinic cell carcinoma. And I was told that there isn't any treatment known for that now, but I wanted to know where I could look into finding any information on it.
Excellent question, and Barbara, I will also speak with you after the call, but that's such an important question. I'm going to ask Dr. Leonard if you could address this in a general way in terms of how one might search this out.
Yes, well, I think that there's been an increasing recognition that for rare diseases and in cancer, rare tumors, that a special effort has to be made to seek out participation in and information from clinical trials, because in the case of rare tumors and rare diseases, it may be that there are only a few people in various areas that have that are dealing with that situation, and it is much more difficult to gather information if those few people are seen across the country or across the world, and if people are not talking to each other or combining their information, trying to get meaningful information on enough patients to be able to make decisions or to bring new treatments forward or to learn about the disease is extremely challenging. And so I think, generally speaking, it is very important for patients with less common diseases in particular, and you could argue, and I would argue, that everyone with cancer should think about clinical trials, but I think if you're dealing with a rare cancer or an uncommon tumor, that that is a place where it may be even more important to seek out a clinical trial. And I think certainly the website that was mentioned, I believe by Dr. Mitchell, the clinicaltrials.gov, that is a place where one can learn about clinical trials for rare diseases in particular. I would say that, you know, there you can search that website, and by putting in information, you might be able to find studies that way. Now, I will say that for certain situations, that website can be hard to navigate, and so I would particularly ask your doctor or your treatment team to help you find that, because sometimes navigating these sorts of things can be difficult. I would certainly urge you in these situations also to seek the advice, again, of your doctor or your treatment center to help you find a clinical trial. Carolyn, I know, is going to stay on the phone with you, and I know Cancer Care, and there are many other more disease-oriented organizations as well. But I think that organizations like Cancer Care can be tremendously helpful, even if they don't have the information themselves, to direct you to a place where you can get the information. And so I think there are resources out there, but you really do have to ask. And in many cases, some of the larger centers around the country also may see enough patients with certain less common types of cancer that they may have specialists in that area or experience in that area. So that's also another way where one can look for those rare disorders. But I would call upon your doctor in particular to direct you in those directions, because that can be very helpful in navigating really what can be quite challenging of finding the few trials or the few experts in these rare sorts of tumors.
You know, the other thing for anyone on the call who has a rare cancer, there is an organization called the National Organization for Rare Disorders, and their 800 number is 1-800-999-6673. Let me repeat that. In short, it's called a capital NORD, which is National Organization for Rare Disorders, and their telephone number is 1-800-999-6673. So that's another resource. And, of course, the National Cancer Institute, in addition to the website, does have, of course, a toll-free number as well, 1-800, the number 4-CANCER. So I hope that's helpful, and we'll talk after the call. But just for others on the call who are just wondering about the same thing, that's really important. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Terry P. Your line is open.
Yeah, I've got esophageal cancer, and I'm not able to eat, and I'm having to use a feeding tube. Once my chemo is done, how long will it take before I'll be able to eat on my own? And also, how long does it take for your hair to grow back?
Well, these are really good questions. We should probably talk after the call as well, but I'm going to ask Dr. Mitchell if she would address it in a general way in terms of some of the issues that often people confront during their treatment, and also just about the hair regrowth as well. Dr. Mitchell?
Yes, and I am certainly very sensitive to all individuals who are undergoing therapy for cancer and who have been through treatment. And, sir, I hope you have success and feel better in the near future. Now, the side effects that occur for patients, many of these side effects are there already from the cancer before even the treatment begins. And certainly the effects of the treatment depend on what kind of chemotherapy, whether or not irradiation is a part of that treatment plan, and whether or not surgery is planned. So while I don't want to be specific and give you medical advice over the telephone, These are things that can be discussed with your doctor and with the healthcare team. There are different medications that are used to treat esophageal cancer, and the selection of the group of medications will therefore give a series of side effects, so that the expectation, both from the side effects and when the side effects will be over, depend on which of those medications your healthcare team selected for you. So I can't tell you specifically when you'll be able to eat or when your hair will grow back, since I don't know the various medications. But overall, with cancer care, patients can expect to see some improvement, but your healthcare team can help you manage the side effects, and they will need to know these side effects so that they can advise you on the treatment for the side effects. So make sure you tell your team about the side effects that you are experiencing and then your questions about resolution of the side effects, such as hair growing back and when you'll be able to eat comfortably again.
Those are so important. And if your appointment, I know a lot of people think they have to wait till the very next appointment, which could be a month from now. I would say you really asked an excellent question on this call today, excellent set of questions. And please feel free, if you don't have an appointment, if your appointment isn't like right away, I would say after the teleconference, go ahead and call your treating team and ask them a question and see if you can't set up a time to talk with them. And if you live a far distance from your treating healthcare team, perhaps you can actually talk with them on the telephone, just so you can get some really answers specifically to, from someone who really knows specifically about your, exactly your cancer, what your treatments are, so you can get some help with that right away. So I hope that helps you. We do have a question from one of our online participants, and actually it's from Terry. And the question is, for patients without health coverage and limited resources, are clinical trials available? Can they still participate in a clinical trial? Dr. Leonard, can you address that?
So that is an important question. As was mentioned earlier, the costs and understanding the costs of a clinical trial are very important to patients, regardless of what your insurance status is, but especially if you have issues and do not have insurance and have special problems with dealing with your insurance coverage or paying for your medical care, which obviously for many people is a particularly important and challenging concern. So I think it is hard to generalize. In some cases, one might argue that participation in a clinical trial is helpful as far as medical costs, because in some cases the clinical trial may cover some of the expenses of care that a person who is paying for that out of pocket would otherwise have to cover. So for some situations, that could be an added bonus, one might say, or at least something that is an added benefit. On the other hand, participation in clinical trials and the care that one gets on a clinical trial is usually not free, meaning that things like standard of care treatment, which is care that you would be getting outside of a clinical trial if you weren't participating, generally your insurance or you personally would still have to cover that, whether or not you're on a clinical trial. And in some cases, the amount of monitoring and care might be perhaps a little bit more than you would expect. And while that may or may not be covered by the clinical trial, there are at least some scenarios where some patients might feel like it's a little more expensive or they are paying a little bit more because of what's happening as part of the clinical trial. That's something that we try very hard to avoid, and most of the time is not an issue. But to be honest, occasionally some patients can experience that. So I think the take-home point is that anything as far as the expenses of clinical trials, it could be a benefit financially. It could be, hopefully it's at least neutral, but in some cases it could be a little bit more of an expense than you might otherwise have. I think it's very important to talk to your treatment team so you understand these issues, and also talk to your insurance company if you do have insurance. And I think if this is an issue for you and your participation, make it clear to your treatment team that the cost of the clinical trial or the expense that you may have, if it is a concern for you and may get in the way of you participating, ask them about it, because in some cases there are things that the clinical trial organizers can do to make it easier for you to participate. And we would hope that that would not be an issue that would keep someone from participating, that being the cost aspects of things. But obviously that's a very important consideration, and you should get all your questions answered in that regard.
Excellent. I also would encourage you, I will say a little bit more about this before we end, but our staff at Cancer Care, the social work staff here, can be very helpful in, with any of the issues around finance and cost of treatment or participation in trials, in terms of just helping you to find all those resources, in addition to talking to your healthcare team about that, so that the goal, of course, is for everyone to have access to the best care for them. We have one other question which I'd like to take before we conclude the call today, and that is phase four the only phase viable for patients with stage four cancer? From Roberto, actually, a question, and I'm wondering if Dr. Wickerham, if you could address that question.
No, the simple answer is no. Phase four simply means that the drug or the therapy has gone through the first three steps and usually received approval from the Food and Drug Administration. And then phase four often gets referred to as post-marketing evaluation after the drug is being used in the general situation it's been approved for. Additional information may come in, particularly relative to toxicities. Stage four cancer trials, however, are extremely common, and all of the various phases of trials may be potentially of value to a patient with stage four disease, and indeed should be something that he or she should be looking forward to potentially including in their care options.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers today. You've been extraordinary. I want to thank all of you who've actually asked questions, either on the telephone or online, that enhanced the call today, and all of you who've been listening. And I do want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do briefly want to review with you the services that you can access from Cancer Care. We have a staff of 45 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services for you. We offer practical and financial assistance, and we offer supportive counseling, a chance to talk with someone, and that's all of our services are free. And you can talk with someone one-on-one or in a support group format, either on the telephone or online. And we also have these workshops, and we also offer practical materials and information as well. And we have an extensive website. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with your cancer. We have a lot of questions. Some of you didn't get to ask your question. I want you to know that you're now part of a community of support, and you can call Cancer Care at any time, 1-800-813-HOPE. That's in all the materials you got from us. Again, 1-800-813-HOPE, or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. We are here to help, and please take advantage of those services. We are simply a telephone call away. I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for your participation.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.